This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa. JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharyson, the editor-in-chief over at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 82 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the NumberFire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. As I've grown older, and yes, I know, I'm not that old, if there's one thing that I've really focused on from just a character and personality perspective, it's an attempt to be as compassionate as I possibly can be. In every situation, maybe aside from when someone's irresponsibly trolling me on Twitter, I try to take a step back and wonder what it's like to be in that person's shoes. Because I don't know. You know, I don't know what it's like to be a person of color in this country. I don't know what it's like to be a woman. I don't know what it's like to be a professional athlete. And I certainly don't know what it's like to be a professional athlete who's also an addict. The unfortunate side to sports is that a lot of fans think that athletes are not humans. And it's not because of the freaky things they can do on the field or on a court. People don't treat athletes as humans because athletes don't live the typical human life. Professional athletes who play major sports make a lot of money, and as a result, there's this dehumanization that occurs. People feel like athletes can't have struggles because they've got money. And that's complete garbage. I'm not sure how much you've read into Josh Gordon's story, but it's one full of sadness, addiction, and human struggle that all of us have gone through in one way or another. Not that all of us know what it's like to go to rehab, but all of us know what it's like to go through things that we didn't intend to go through. Maybe you're dealing with depression. Maybe there are health issues in your family. Maybe you lost your job and you just have such little hope for the future. These are the worst parts of being a human. And just because you're an athlete, that doesn't mean that you don't go through these same things. It doesn't mean that you've lost feeling. On Sunday, Josh Gordon is returning to the football field for the first time since 2014. Rather than looking at what Gordon's doing in such a negative way that we often see on social media, rather than saying, man, you ruined your career because you couldn't stay away from drugs, I think it's amazingly important that we watch him on the football field this weekend as humans. And we celebrate that. We celebrate the fact that Josh Gordon did get help and that he is trying to make himself a better person. Just because he succeeded at the highest level in football doesn't mean he doesn't need support. So let's support him. Let's hope the dude goes off and doesn't need to go back to the lifestyle that he once lived. Let's be compassionate. That's really all I'm trying to say here. Let's be compassionate people. And let's enjoy watching one hell of a football player match up against a really good secondary. Because, woo baby, that matchup is going to be fun. Before getting to this week's mailbag questions, I wanted to let you know that boxing superstar Miguel Cotto steps into the ring for one final time when he takes on Saddam Ali live Saturday, December 2nd at 10 p.m. Eastern and Pacific, only on HBO. You don't want to miss it. All right, now let's answer some mailbag questions. This first one's from Twitter, @John_is_a_boss. John is a boss. John, who is a boss, says, is it wrong or illegal to intentionally lose my game and put up only 50 points in the hopes that I fall down one playoff spot and get the easier matchup? The guy who I'm playing would need to beat me by 90 to get into the playoffs, so I don't think that it's collusion. I've gotten so many questions around tanking over the last couple of weeks, so let me just throw out all of my thoughts right here, right now. John, who is a boss, in your case, you can do what you wish because you're locked into the playoffs. This is just my opinion, of course. If you want to influence who you play or who your competition is, that's all part of the game, because this is a game. One word of caution, though. I think a lot of times people get too arrogant with this approach because they think they know which team is worse, but often that team will outscore the other team anyway, and all of a sudden you screwed yourself. Unless it's very, very obvious, I shy away from doing something like this. Now, if there's a team that's completely out of the playoffs and it's a complete redraft league, so there's no keepers, and that team that's completely out of the hunt is losing on purpose just because he or she wants someone else out of the playoffs, that's where I have issues. If a team is out, they should at the very least be setting a lineup. They should be competitive. And if they're not, then you've got yourself an owner problem and a motivation problem in your league. The commissioner has to ensure that owners are checking lineups and that they're active, but there are also ways to motivate teams to be competitive in these scenarios. Like give them a penalty if they start inactive players, or kick them out of the league if they're tanking just because they don't want a certain team in the playoffs, or do weekly payouts. There are tons of ways to avoid this, but those people also suck as human beings, for the record. The people who throw just because they want a friend to make the playoffs instead of someone else, those people suck. Lastly, there's the Dynasty or Keeper League component as well. A lot of people get angry when lopsided trades go down close to the playoffs, but that's also what Dynasty and Keeper Leagues are all about. You can't hate on people who are out of it for wanting to set themselves up for future seasons while exploiting teams who are looking to win now. You can't hate them for that. I talked about this on a previous podcast, but if you're in a keeper league with just a couple of keepers, having a keeper trade deadline that's earlier in the season works really well too. We started doing that in my home league that I'm the commissioner for. It allows for trading to go down closer to the end of the year, but at some point, like late October, players who are traded cannot be kept. Some of these answers may not be popular. I totally understand that. I'm very much a believer, though, that as long as what you're doing has everything to do with your personal gain in fantasy football without collusion with another team, I think that's totally fine. Sometimes that screws over other owners, but that's what happens when you're playing a competitive game. This next one's from at Bethany L. Peters. We've probably already chosen defenses for week 13, but which defenses are good streamers throughout the playoffs each week that might be wise for us to stash now, particularly interested in week 15. So I talked about this a bit on a mailbag episode a few weeks ago, but things may have changed. I get it. So I'm going to just spit out some defensive plays from here on out. Just gonna spit some fire. Just say it as fast as I can. And I feel like when I do this, I need some sort of intense song in the background, like the 90s commercial jingle to the game Crossfire. So let's do it. Week 14, Green Bay at Cleveland, Buffalo at home against Indianapolis, Cincinnati at home against Chicago. Those are three streamers. Week 15. Lions at home versus Chicago, maybe Washington at home against Arizona, Buffalo at home against Miami, the Saints at home against the Jets. And then in week 16, you have Chicago at home against Cleveland, Kansas City at home against Miami, Washington at home against Denver, the Cardinals are at home also against the Giants. So those are some streaming options from week 14 through 16. Hope it helps. Next one, at the Webs 02. What's your process on evaluating safety for a player when setting your roster? Is it just looking at the past few games points scored? I did a podcast earlier this offseason called Predictability and Positional Tiers. It was episode 29. And in it, I talked about the predictability aspect of fantasy football and overall roster balancing. Because there are times where you want a predictable floor asset as opposed to one with a lot of variance. That definitely happens in your weekly decision making. Floor players, or players who are safer and might not have a huge ceiling. So I'm not talking about Antonio Brown here. Antonio Brown has a nice floor, but also a nice ceiling every single week. But if you want some defined characteristics of those high floor, low ceiling players, they're players who are bound to see volume, but they may not have a ton of scoring opportunities. Maybe someone in a bad offense, but will see a lot of touches like Kenyon Drake this weekend. It's not about looking at the last few weeks of fantasy points scored though either. Because as we know, fantasy points can be skewed by things like big plays and touchdowns. And a small 3-week sample will not tell us a whole lot about how those points were accumulated. You've got to dig deeper and look at usage and importance within that player's individual offense. This next one's a little bit old, but it's still very relevant. Hi JJ, discovered the late round pod this season and I love how it's packed with information in such a short amount of time. Just like some of the stats you mentioned, you're efficient for us. Thanks. You noted on a recent pod that you hate rankings. This may garner an obvious answer for a seasoned listener, but what is the alternative for rookie fantasy players like me that play casually with coworkers or friends? Regards, Patrick. Just to be clear, I don't think fantasy football rankings are worthless, especially for casual players of the game. I just think that we as analysts are trying to educate folks and make them more interested in playing fantasy football. So we should be more transparent as to how we get these rankings. I mean, the bottom line is that literally anyone can make fantasy football rankings. My 5-year-old niece can make fantasy football rankings. And for a ton of people, it's a subjective exercise. There's no formula to it. There's analysis that allows rankings to be pieced together, but our brains aren't capable of really separating one player from the next without insane detail or formulas. Let me just give you an example. Rankings are linear in that the player ranked first is the same distance from the player ranked second, who's the same distance from the player who ranks third, and so on. But oftentimes there are gaps, and that creates tiers. And a lot of times the difference between, say, the 13th and the 15th ranked running back is just very, very minimal. And when the fantasy football industry pushes rankings as like the way to analyze and the thing that you need to do in order to be a part of the industry, I just simply disagree with that notion. I can't tell you how many writing samples that I've gotten from people where it's just like a weekly rankings list. That's their writing sample. Like, why would that differentiate you as a writer and analyst? Why are these important? Because rankings aren't helping people understand the why. And when people are just handed a ranking sheet, They blindly make moves off of that sheet, and they don't think nearly as much about strategy in fantasy football. So overall, I don't think that rankings are bad when casual owners are trying to make lineup decisions. But I do think that if the fantasy football industry wants to continue to get more and more people involved with fantasy football on a more detailed level, then we need to do more with actual projections and talk more about strategy than simply just making a list of rankings and say, follow this and you'll be good. And for the record, this isn't me pooping on other analysts who make rankings. It's a great marketing tool, and they are helpful, especially for the people who make weekly projections that create the baseline for those rankings. I just think that we can do more and we can do better as an industry overall. This next one's from Twitter, at Desperado28. As a streamer of tight end, quarterback, kicker, and defense, does it make sense to vary your streamers across multiple leagues, particularly high variance plays such as Jameis Winston this week? Yes, absolutely. I've said this many times, but I view my fantasy football leagues as a giant portfolio. Some players I'll have a ton of exposure to, and some players I won't. But in the end, as I like to say during draft time when you have a lot of teams, it's not about just getting the same dudes that you love over and over again. It's about just avoiding players that you absolutely hate. For instance, I didn't get a ton of Todd Gurley this year in my fantasy leagues because I wasn't in love with the Rams offense coming into the year. That screwed me a little bit. But I do have him on a couple of squads because I knew that Todd Gurley had a wide range of outcomes. That's no different than how you can approach the game weekly because variance exists. So yes, you should absolutely hedge, but you have to remember to be optimal while doing so. Don't hedge just because you're playing scared. That's what gets folks in trouble with DFS each week, when they try to capture every scenario that could possibly go down in a given week. You can't do that, and it's not optimal to do that. You've got to still try and get your good core together and then vary your pieces around that core group. This next one's from Bear Mullings. Thoughts on this hypothetical league format? Auction draft, $300 budget, all money left at the end of the auction is converted to your FOB for the season, rather than a traditional $200 and $100 split. Do you prioritize spending early or later in the year? Yeah, that's where the strategy component comes into play. I'm actually in one of these leagues with fantasy analyst Chris Harris, along with some other analysts, and then some really awesome writers and people who work in Hollywood. It's a great league. It's a six-player keeper league, and during the auction draft, your leftover money becomes your FOB. And as a side note, that actually ended up being one of my better teams this year because I got Kareem Hunt and Alvin Kamara cheap because the draft happened before the Spencer Ware injury. And on top of that, I got LeSean McCoy and Antonio Brown. So things are looking pretty nice in that league for me. But yes, it's a great format. And the way that I approach it is I don't really worry about FOB all that much. I have some left over, but I don't worry about it all that much because your actual draft money is way more important. This next one is from at RajiFresh47. What do you prioritize when evaluating matchups? Probable game script or opponent strength against position? Take, for example, Joe Mixon versus the Browns. This is a great question. I think we always have to remember that the number one thing that you want in fantasy football is volume. You need attempts and targets for running backs. You need targets for wide receivers and tight ends. You need volume. So then you have to ask yourself, what generates volume? Well, good matchups definitely can generate some volume. If a wide receiver is facing a terrible cornerback, the hope is that the quarterback can exploit that matchup and target the wide receiver relentlessly. And if the running back is facing a bad rush defense, you're hoping that the coach game plans around the running back in that matchup. But I will say, a lot of times, matchups are just exploited through game script as well. For instance, the Eagles do have a great rush defense, don't get me wrong. The personnel is good to stop the run. And they're more beatable through the air. But that's also enhanced because the Eagles are always leading, so teams always have to throw the ball against them. So there is some overlap here with matchups and game flow. But if I were to choose just one, I would absolutely choose good game script over a good matchup. And there are a couple of reasons for this. A good game script means that something happened in order for a team to get into the lead in the first place. So with Joe Mixon against the Browns, something enabled him to get into that good game flow, and that was points scored by the offense to start the game. He didn't score those points, but he could have scored those points. This is why people will often get the whole, this quarterback will be trailing and therefore he's a better play thing wrong. Because if the quarterback is trailing, that means he probably played like crap to start the game, which caused the negative game script. So all you're saying there is that you're hoping to get second half fantasy points when your quarterback couldn't get first half fantasy points. But in a positive script, the quarterback is always in a position to score from start to finish. And the same holds true for a running back and to a lesser degree wide receiver, because volume matters a lot at wide receiver and can come late in a negative script. But think of it this way. Fantasy football is driven by volume, which then creates touchdowns. Touchdowns are the end result that you want. In negative game script situations, touchdowns not only haven't happened or more than likely haven't happened at a high rate to start the game, which is why you're in a negative script to begin with, but then they're more difficult to come by when defenses have you backed up against the wall. So even if you have a player in a sick, nasty matchup, if that team is in a negative script, that's not a good thing. You can't easily exploit that matchup then. Give me the favorable game script all day long. This last one is from @shunter86. My surname is Gregson, and I get called Greg a lot in emails, even though my first name is right frickin' there. Do you occasionally get called Zach or Zachary? Okay, so I have two main pet peeves. The first is when people are just unbelievably oblivious to their surroundings, because I view that kind of stuff as selfishness. You know when you're driving and you're looking to make a right turn at a stop sign and the person in front of you is just sitting there despite there not being any traffic? They're just looking at their phone without realizing that there's a freaking car behind them? Those small things drive me absolutely nuts. Like, have some awareness that other people exist on this planet. But the other pet peeve is when people call me Zach. My last name is Zachariesen, guys. My first name is JJ. Well, it's two things that combine to make JJ, but my name is not Zach. I think what annoys me most when people call me Zach, because I've thought about this, I'm all about self-awareness. I want to dig into why I feel the way that I do. But I think the reason why I get so annoyed is because I'm very much a relationship kind of person. And so when someone calls me Zach, they're basically saying, I actually don't know you at all, which is why I'm calling you something that is not your name. I know it probably sounds stupid, but it drives me absolutely insane. Anyway, that's the last question for today's show. I appreciate you guys listening, as always. If you've yet to subscribe to the show, do so by going to TuneIn, iTunes, SoundCloud, Google Play, and Stitcher. And don't forget to leave a rating and review on iTunes, guys. Next week, one random reviewer will win a free NumberFire premium subscription for an entire year. I'm also on Twitter, @LateRoundQB. Thanks, everyone. Enjoy your weekend.